Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guest today is Dee Dee Halleck. Well, I've known Dee Dee for some many years in the world of independent media, but this is the first time we're doing an interview, and I know that you have been very much on the cutting edge with activist video, Dee Dee, and the founder of Paper Tiger TV and co-founder of Deep Dish. Is that what you said? And I don't even know what the difference between those are. You will tell us about it, I hope, and we're here in Berkeley because you were here working with the Independent Media Center in San Francisco, and also you have been having an exhibit at the University of California Art Museum, and your film shown at the Pacific Film Archive, so people should know that you are a very active person and have done a lot of things. I just recently saw this one about Manana Land. This film was very wonderful. You talked about how you got involved in started thinking about film and video. So let's hear from you about how you did get involved and what are Deep Dish and Paper Tiger.
Well, to start with the Gringo and Manana Land, when I was young, I grew up in Tennessee, but my father got a job at a nickel mine in Cuba. So I ended up going to Cuba at the age of 12. It was before the revolution, and it was quite a stark kind of contrast between the America that I knew and the Central Caribbean America that I found, and particularly with a kind of exploitative nature of the U.S. Mining interests there. And they had a movie house where they would show films to the workers, which my mother let me go because she wanted me to keep up my contact with my American culture. And so I saw a ton of Hollywood movies, and I think that's where I learned to love media. And I realized that there was quite a contrast between the world that I saw in the movies and the world that I saw in front of me, and the kind of lives that the workers had to live at this very exploitative mine. And I think it kind of made me committed to social activism from a very early age. And then actually I went back to Tennessee and got involved with the Highlander School, which is at that point was in Grundy County near Mount Eagle, Tennessee, and they've now moved to Knoxville and they're still doing good work, but that was like the late 50s, early 60s, and they were doing a lot of civil rights training and leadership training, and actually Rosa Parks went to a Highlander workshop before she sat in the front of the bus. Like 2 weeks before, she'd been at a Highlander workshop where they were doing things like acting out situations like that. So I took part in a number of those workshops, and I think it had a great impact on me. It was while I was in high school, and then later got involved in media and began working with video when that came around. At first I was making films, and then I got involved with video and got very interested in the public access and trying to develop programs for public access, programs that were low budget, creative, imaginative, and high content. And Paper Tiger seemed like a pretty good sort of format. The idea was that one person who was knowledgeable about a particular field would comment on it. And it was the program was initially aimed at looking at the media. So each show, we started out with six programs with Herb Schiller reading the New York Times. Herb died last year. He was a wonderful communication professor at the University of California, San Diego, where I am now a professor. And Herb had a very sort of sardonic way of analyzing the mass media. He was one of the real founders of the critical media movement. He did a book in 1967 called The Mind Managers, actually, which to this day is a very prescient, amazing look at the kind of corporate media that we have now, even to a greater extent than he could have ever imagined. So,
yeah, really. Oh, I'm glad you mentioned, too, that you were a professor, because I didn't even say that. I used to see you out in the streets and as an activist, and of course I know that you're a professor. And so you really have a lot of view of a lot of different aspects of the media and the movement for a long time. It's interesting to hear about the Highlander School, too. I know that many of the major civil rights leaders and lots of people were very influenced, and I would imagine that a lot of people these days have no idea, or not that they even knew then, but that they even don't know now. There's so much people don't know because of the mainstream media just covering this very little small sliver of things, and that's something that concerns you a lot. You've made so many films here and been involved most recently in the Independent Media Center. Before we get into the Independent Media Center, what about Deep Dish TV? Is that right, Deep Dish TV?
Okay, well, Paper Tiger, from the beginning, it started in 81, and it was very successful. And people were hungry for the programs, not just because of the content, but public access stations around the country saw them immediately. Many people who are working very hard in public access, believe me, a thankless job, but very important. What we were trying to do with Paper Tiger was to say, we have to develop our own aesthetic for public access.
Do you think everybody knows what public access TV means? Because I always like to be very careful of not throwing around kind of words that people in the in-group take for granted.
Well, public access is a very unique phenomena, or it used to be unique here in the United States. Fortunately, it's actually moving around the world, and there's now public access facilities in many countries in Europe, and also in Japan and Brazil have just initiated public access legislation that requires basically that the public be allowed to have certain channels dedicated for free speech, for tapes that they produce, and in some cases, certainly the majority in the United States of public access stations actually have training facilities, equipment, studios where people can come in and actually use the facilities. Now, this is not out of the kindness of the cable company's heart. This comes from very tough struggle and negotiation that goes on between the different communities and the cable corporations, which basically, when they come into a community, are given a monopoly to print money from those people who have their cable, who want television. And so you have a situation where it's actually one of the few successful situations, I think, where corporations are kind of taxed to provide a public interest. And in many people, it's denigrated and it's ridiculed around with the films like Wayne's World and the various articles that have talked about public access as this vanity video or whatever. And to be honest, a lot of the programs on public access are pretty lame. But part of our mission at Paper Tiger was to try to show that there are people with resources, with knowledge that needs to be imparted to your community, and you can do it in a simple and fun way that is creative and doesn't try to mimic the networks. A lot of people come to public access and they try to do very high-end productions and they get very discouraged because there's no money. The facilities aren't up to the par of the networks and their programs look half-baked, whatever. And so they don't want to, they kind of get discouraged and don't ever make programs again. And we're saying, like, get a format, get a group together that you can work well with and do a regular show. Because one of the things about public access is being on a regular basis. Like, you know that as a radio producer. If you're on the same time, same channel, people will find you. And if you're offering information that you can't get anywhere else, people will find you. And that's what we found with Paper Tiger. In fact, if we're not on, if the access stations forget to put the tape on, our office is deluged with calls with people saying, where's your show? It's supposed to be on TV right now, and it's not on. I tune in. Where's Paper Tiger? So we know we have quite a few viewers. It's in Manhattan. And so what happened was we started getting all these questions, all these requests for our tapes from all over the country. And we had said early on that if people would send us a blank tape, we would send it back. We would tape a show and send it back. Well, that got logistically impossible to do because we get 70 or 80 requests a month for copies of our tapes. So we decided to start looking into doing satellite distribution. And actually, the right wing caught on to satellite distribution very early on. They've been uplinking the 700 Club and various other egregious anti-gay racist programming for many years. But we found out that it's not all that expensive. It's a straight commercial deal. You pay the money and you get the transponder on the satellite. And so Deep Dish began when we started sending programs up. But rather than just do Paper Tiger shows, we decided that why should we privilege Paper Tiger, that there was excellent public access being done around the country. And what we wanted to do was kind of be a showcase for that. So we started, we organized programs around themes. So, for example, we did a show on housing and homelessness. But we had homeless people from Santa Monica, from Pittsburgh, from Minneapolis, from Tampa, and it was a way of kind of recontextualizing the news, because when you look at corporate media, they'll have, like 2 minutes of some homeless situation in Philadelphia, and then they'll switch to the situation in Israel or whatever. So it kind of whizzes past mm-hmm. you. Whereas in this case, we showed that, hey, yeah, there was homelessness in Philadelphia, but there's also homelessness in Santa Monica, and there's also homelessness in Tampa. And we would show that this is like a national problem. Mm-hmm. But by focusing on various local aspects of that, and also by really allowing the participation of all these different people from public access and independent producers from around the country, people felt like it was really their project. It wasn't just Deep Dish producers from New York making a show about these places. This was a real grassroots network. So we had, if we would do a series of, say, 10 programs, each program would have maybe 15, 20 segments of 2 minutes each, right? 2 to 3 minutes each, and from 20 different places. So you multiply that by 10, we have 200. So we're getting programs from 200 different locations. And so we had 200 different downlinkers. So people from those locations would, of course, want to downlink the series because their show was on it. So it gave a great incentive to really have people work in their communities to make sure that their access station would downlink the programs. They'd know what time they were coming on. They would downlink it, and then they'd play it on their local station. So when we started, I remember saying to people, well, if we get 30 stations to do this, we've already been cost-effective because we would get more programs out than it would cost us to mail those programs out. We would save money. And so the first series, I think we had 167 stations around the country that downlinked the show, that got it, and that put it on the air.
Wow, that's really, you got to be, that distribution is always so difficult, yeah. Or often so difficult. That's really, you always got to think about that. Good idea.
And there was funny things that happened. Like one of the notices when we sent out, we said, and you only have to use one tape because each week you can erase the tape from before and put it on. But what we found was that people valued the program so much that they didn't erase them. And actually, if you go to Tucson, Arizona, you can open up the door in their access station and they have what they call the deep dish closet. And it's all the tapes that we've sent down that they've taped. And they keep them. And sometimes they'll have deep dish weekend and they'll just play back-to-back deep dish tapes. Or they'll have Deep Dish Week where every night at 10 o'clock from 10 to 12, they'll play two Deep Dish shows. So even though they're kind of out of date or whatever, the people feel that this is a way of not only showcasing access, but really it kind of is a way of proving that public access can have content that's deep, that's meaningful, that is really not the kind of vanity video that a lot of people associate with public access.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dee Dee Hallock, a lot of people don't even know what's possible. They don't even think about it, of course, because they're just watching the corporate TV, and they don't even think of other possibilities very often, I would imagine. I'd like to now move on to this. I have questions about governance, but I'd like to for you to talk about the independent media centers, because both of us have been part of those, and you've actually written up something about how to start an independent media center, and you have Free Speech TV that's come out of, or I don't know if you describe it that way, but that's connected to the independent media center. So tell us your view of all this.
Well, I don't think anybody in last November could have predicted what would have happened at Seattle. I think people were pretty excited and felt that this was a very important event, and that's why a lot of people went to Seattle. But I think the sense of solidarity.
I just want to say that when we talk about Seattle, we're talking about the demonstrations against the World Trade Organizations that happened there when the World Trade Organization met in Seattle last 99, end of November, beginning of December. And there were very big demonstrations, and we had the first independent media center.
Yeah, it's less than a year ago, and when you think of what's happened in that year, it's really quite amazing, because what happened was a coming together, not just of people with issues, because there were people who, the union people came together with the environmental people, because both of them feel that the World Trade Association makes a mockery of this kind of any kind of legislation to try to stem the flow of environmental devastation. At the same time, the way they treat workers is really pathetic in terms of never really requiring that there be fair wages, etc. So it was an amazing coming together of many different movements, people who had been involved for years with anti-sweatshop work, people who were involved with saving the turtles, people who were involved with the rainforests, people involved with indigenous people. So it was a coming together of that. And at the same time, it was a coming together of people, of all the media people and the people who work in micro radio, the people who work with the web and do very creative use of web pages for activist causes. It was a coming together of the video activists and the radio people who are on various community stations and, of course, the micro stations. So you had a coming together of people that for the first time there was a sense that people could and should work together. And it was very exciting. People felt very empowered, because often you're doing your little videotape. You might be working on some documentary for several years trying to raise money. And this was like a spontaneous thing. People just gave, even though there wasn't really enough money to do it, even though it seemed totally impossible. All of a sudden, it blossomed. There was this wonderful fruit that happened, and people really got excited. And at And what's happened since then is this has been replicated in many cities, not just in the United States, but in other countries, in Windsor, Ontario, in Prague, and in France, in a little tiny town named Milieu, where Joseph Beauvais was on trial. All of a sudden, there were 10,000 activists there. They set up an independent media center. You got live coverage of it on the web. No one would have thought this was possible. Of course, what makes it possible is the technology, and the real creativity of the people who often work at kind of boring corporate jobs, but who are very happy to finally find an outlet and feel like they're doing something good in this world. So we had people, for example, at the conventions, we broadcast 40 hours live from both the Philly and the LA conventions, the Republican presidential party, the Republican Party at the presidential convention, and also the Democratic Party meeting in Philly. And we had
Democrats met in LA, the Republicans
right,
met in Philadelphia.
Yeah. And so
a lot of meetings.
And so what we ended up was we had people just walk in LA. I couldn't believe it. Like some these guys who were like gaffers who, you know, ordinarily their pay is like $700 an hour would come in and they brought their lights with them. And we had donations of videotape. People were really giving in an extraordinary way. In Philly, we had some wonderful professional crews who came in and helped set up the light stand and who brought in tripods, and it just is like a miracle. There's so much enthusiasm for the work.
Yeah. I also want to say that I was not in Philadelphia, but I was in L.A. I was in Seattle, and most recently in San Francisco, where we started just starting an independent media center. And there are also people who come in who don't know anything, just
right.
totally off the street. Some are activists, some are not, and I mean it's the other end of the spectrum, and we're all there together.
Yeah, it's been very interesting seeing how it takes shape, and that's one of the reasons actually we decided to try to do a kind of handbook of how to do this work. And I know Sue has done some work on helping people figure out how to do a radio interview, for example. And we also wanted to give people like hints on how to handle backlighting if you're trying to do an interview so you don't have it in a silhouette. Because sometimes it's people who just pick up their uncle's camera, come down and hop down to the center, and they don't know how to even focus it. But we're able to kind of use a kind of mentoring situation so that more experienced people help the younger people. And it's very exciting. And it's all on the web. I mean, that's the other thing. It's like it's out there. You can post your video. You can post your audio. You can post your photographs. And actually, one of the things we have at the museum is a whole wall of photographs from all the different IMCs. And it's a wonderful exhibit. And each photograph is 11 by 17. And it just came from a printer. And we printed it out directly from the web. And we want to encourage people to print out some of these photographs, have an exhibit in your own community. The URL is indymedia.org, and you can go there, and if you do a search for photos, you can get like all separated off all the different photos, and you can print them out and have your own exhibit. We want it to be sort of like the AIDS quilt, like that it would be a traveling exhibit that would go from city to city, but it could also you could make your own, mm-hmm. and it could change and evolve as the situation changes and evolves.
Right. Well, and the situation is changing and evolving things. Of course, the rate of change is very, very quick these days. I want to say you can also go to audio and get the radio shows. You can go to video and get the videotapes, and you can go to and you can see the print stories. That's a nice thing that these indie media, again, we're going to give you the webpage, www.indiemedia.com. Spelled IndyMedia.org, and then that will lead you to all the other web pages all over the world. And probably by the time you hear this, there'll be even some new ones. But I wanted to ask you in the few remaining minutes, Dee Dee Halleck, if you would talk a little bit about the governance of Paper Tiger and Deep Dish. TV and the Independent Media Center, because there's so many good ideas and so many great things that people do, and it oftentimes comes how we treat each other. The power dynamics are very important in real life on a day-to-day basis, and often actually destroy very good organizations. So you have collectives. Your Paper Tiger and Deep Dish are collectives, or how does that work?
Well, Paper Tiger is pretty much like an anarchist collective. It's whoever comes to the meeting can participate, and if there's, they try to make all decisions by consensus. So, there are some paid staff, but those staff are hired by the collective itself, and their pay is basically a kind of minimum wage. It's not like there's an executive director of Paper Tiger. Mm-hmm. And Paper Tiger is self-sufficient. Paper Tiger is able to exist through a few grants, but mostly from sales of videos. Deep Dish has a board of directors. I'm one of the members of the board of directors. There's a number of other people on the board, and basically we have a staff that the board hires, and we've been able to kind of maintain a kind of, it's been really hard to kind of keeping Deep Dish alive, because we don't have that kind of ongoing sustaining. One of the things that we're hopeful about in the future is that with Free Speech TV, we now have access to a 24-hour satellite, and we don't have to pay for the satellite rental. So this is making a big difference, and we have all kinds of plans for doing a series on youth, for doing Democracy Now! On video. So hopefully starting in November, it would be an ongoing series that we would do. And we would be working actually with doing some music stuff with Michael Franti and other musicians on a regular basis. So the music videos that MTV won't let you see that would be coming down on a direct satellite, the Free Speech TV satellite, which you can get from the Dish Network.
Okay. Well, we have just like another minute. So I'd like you to say something about the IMC governing structure, if there is any, and then give some contact information. And we're off.
Well, I think the IMC really patterns itself off after the activist groups that it kind of came into being to document, and that is a consensus kind of set up, and with meetings every afternoon, lots of meetings. If you don't want like meetings, you shouldn't try to come to an IMC, because you're kind of obliged to go to a bunch of meetings. But I must say I've really felt that I've learned a lot about consensus decision making through the IMC, and I think it's really a good process, and it's worked so far, and let's hope it keeps working. I think as the IMC movement gets larger, that becomes more difficult, and we're starting to talk now about having representatives being sent to some kind of a council that would be put together. So who knows where
democracy is this challenge.
Yes, it's always a challenge.
Okay, so we've got indiemedia.org. It's for the independent media.
You can get papertiger.org or deepdish.igc.org. igc.org/deepdish. That will get you to the Deep Dish site. And freespeech.org for the Free Speech site. And you can find out about getting one of the satellite dishes there.
Oh, there's so much more we could talk about, but I'm so happy that we could do this interview, Dee Dee Halleck. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Sue. It's great to see all the work you've been doing.
Yeah. Thanks so much. Yeah, and this is Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.